Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. If you've been following the conflict in Ukraine online and from media, you've been fed a steady diet of opinions like who are the good guys and who are the bad guys and who's winning or losing. Context is largely absent, and that's on purpose. Crosstalking media coverage of Ukraine. I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Lazar, in New York. He is a journalist and author of three books on the U.S. Constitution. In Bethesda, we cross to Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, as well as co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. And here in Moscow, we have Maxim Suchkov. He is the director of the Center for Advanced American Studies at Moscow State Institute of International Relations. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Peter, let me go to you first in Bethesda. I have to watch cable news. I have to read the mainstream media because I have to understand what they're talking about. And I'm demanding, you know, hardship pay because it's brutal to consume that information here. I mean, you've watched some of it, obviously, as well. And the context of the conflict is completely absent. It's as if this something started just a little over a month ago, completely out of the blue. And when I bring up topics like the Minsk agreements and things like that, most people don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Peter, your thoughts?
You're identifying a serious problem. There is no historical memory on mass media in the United States, and for that reason, in that sense, over much of the world. So people can't put this in context. If you don't understand context, you can't figure out the solutions and the way out. For the 3 months leading up to this war, when the troops were on the border, I must have done 75 interviews on Russian television, in which I kept on urging Putin to declare victory. The world, for the first time in decades, was talking about Russia's national security concerns, and Putin was in a position to declare victory, remove those troops, begin serious negotiation. And he didn't do it. And we're talking about the lack of context in the media. There's also lack of historical context and understanding on the part of most global leaders. And Putin fell into that trap. I was shocked that he did this. I was shocked that he didn't learn the lessons from the Afghan invasion in 1979, from the U.S. invasion of Vietnam, the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. These things don't end up the way these leaders think. When Brezhnev went into Afghanistan in 1979, he said it was going to be over within a month. Putin had that same illusion about Ukraine. And we've created a global situation now that I think is so much worse for Russia than it would have been had the Russia not invaded, for the whole planet right now. We've created a very, very dangerous situation, as well as a humanitarian catastrophe inside Ukraine. So I'm very disappointed, and I'm upset, and I'm angry, because what Putin has done in large part is to legitimize all the militarists, all the hawks, all the people who want to strengthen NATO, all the people who want to increase military spending around the planet, in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere. So I think that we've touched off really a very, very dangerous situation.
There's a lot said there, Peter, but I don't think, you need Russia and Putin to legitimize the neoconservatives and all the arms makers, okay? It wasn't necessary. It was already in the cards, but I get your point here. Daniel, let me go to you, because, when we had the White House coming out saying Russia's suffered a strategic defeat in Ukraine. Now, being able to say that assumes that you know what the plan was. Well, obviously, they didn't. So I don't understand how they can possibly say that there is a strategic defeat. It sounds great, but it is completely divorced to reality on the ground. Daniel, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S., and in particular, the U.S. Democrats have been mounting a nonstop campaign of demonization of Russia and Putin that's been going, full force since 2011. I mean, Putin, as far as the Democrats are concerned, is a Elders of Zion style, you know, manipulator, world manipulator, source of evil, source of endless subversion. He's been demonized. And this is ridiculous. And there's no question that, number one, that a trap was laid for him by this relentless eastward push by NATO. And there's no question that that the U.S. Taunted him into invading with the endless cries that, you know, he was about to send his troops in, look out, look out. I mean, yes, I agree that Putin did fall into the trap, but that trap was laid by the U.S. over the course of a decade. And so the U.S. really bears the lion's share of responsibility for this entire debacle. And I agree, it's extraordinarily dangerous. I think the world is plunging over a 1914-style cliff.
I agree with that. And you know, if I go to Max here, I think let's settle this, guys. It was a trap. Everybody agrees with that, okay? I still think that there were very few options, unfortunately, because of the nature of that trap. Max, go ahead and react to what we've already heard today. Go ahead.
Well, I think, since the breakup of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, there were three major narratives in the Russian foreign policy discourse on what U.S. policy in Ukraine and in the East Europe is all about. One discourse is the so-called, you know, the geostrategic kind of big Brzezinski type of narrative that says that, you know, the West has to invest in Ukraine and ultimately make anti-Russia out of Ukraine to make sure that Russia is cut off from Europe, and Ukraine is a huge kind of anti-Russian buffer state. That's why you need to invest a lot into their nationalist identity. You know, that is the basis for their contemporary statehood. The second narrative was, in a way, U.S. acted as a superpower on autopilot. You know, it didn't really care much for Russia's concerns. It just went the way it did because it was an ultimate victor in the Cold War. And, you know, the policy was pretty much, we'll do as we wish and you will suffer what you must. So Russia's concerns were not taken into account. And the third narrative is really is kind of a superpower that outsources its Russia policy to the states that have traditional historical grievances with Russia, you know, the Poles, the Baltics, and they get to dictate to the rest of the West what their Russia policy should be. So basically, I think the Russia security guarantees back in December were a litmus test for what really was driving U.S. foreign policy in that part of Europe. And we now see that people who thought that was kind of a mixture of the three, but more so the first narrative, this kind of geopolitical driving factor, and this outsourcing, we see the way the Poles and the Baltics are now emboldened, pretty much, you know, gives policymakers in Moscow a sense that there is really little you can agree with the United States as far as European security and Ukraine's future. And that's very sad, because ultimately I think the peace would have to be sought between Moscow and Washington.
Let me go back to Peter. I mean, going back to what Max said, the first narrative right there. Well, they've won. Russia has been cut off from Europe. Okay, so the Europeans should be happy about that. Is that good for Europe? Because that seals Europe's fate, as far as I'm concerned, and they're isolated. Go ahead, Peter.
I don't think this situation is good for anybody, Peter. I think that everybody's suffering. I mean,
Peter, I'm sorry, but do you think Victoria Nuland is suffering? I bet she's drinking champagne. Jake Sullivan, I'm sure he's happy. I mean, Boris Johnson seems to be overwhelmingly happy as well. I mean, they're happy about this outcome, okay? So, I mean, this isn't accidental. It was planned, and it's happened. Go ahead, Peter.
They're happy in the same sense that Brzezinski broke open the champagne in 1979 when he induced the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. You know, in public, he cried crocodile tears. Behind the scenes, he was elated.
Yep.
He said, now we've given the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. And then the effect that had on Afghanistan and on the Soviet Union was devastating. Some people are trying to do the same thing in this situation. Some of the concern is sincere. And I mean, there's a lot, we see the pictures, we know what's going on. In many ways, it's a humanitarian catastrophe, what's going on inside of Ukraine now. And then there are a lot of other people who want to use this strategically to weaken Russia. So there's both going on. What we need to figure out, and the world needs to figure out, is how to end it as quickly as possible. What is the basis for a negotiated settlement that allows Putin to save some face, get some of what he wants?
But Peter, but who is talking about ending it? Nobody in the West, no policymakers are. Daniel, please talk about it. It's just more arms, that's what they're talking about. No one in the West is talking about peace. Go ahead, Daniel.
I totally agree. I mean, Brzezinski, in his 1997 bestseller, The Grand Chessboard, talked about using the Ukraine as a battering ram with which to effect the breakup of Russia into three separate parts under U.S. tutelage. And then the U.S. would penetrate deep into Central Asia to begin attacking China. So what we see here, I mean, if assuming Brzezinski's influence is still ongoing, and I think it is, I mean, what we see here is truly an existential threat to Russia and an attempt to then penetrate into Central Asia and attack Russia, attack China from the West, from Xinjiang, which is its most vulnerable province. I don't support what Putin did, but I certainly understood the thinking that led him to do what he did do. And the threat from the U.S. is quite real, it's quite frightening, and there's no indication that the U.S. was at any point prepared to let up and seek any kind of rational accommodation with the Russian Federation.
Yes, Peter, can I ask Daniel a question on that?
Peter, you're going to ask him a question right after our hard break. So we're going to go to a hard break, and right after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on media coverage of Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing media coverage of Ukraine. Okay, Peter, at the very last second of the first part of the program, you wanted to ask Daniel a question. Please go right ahead.
Daniel, before the invasion, Zelensky was saying that he was willing to accept that Ukraine would not join NATO and would effectively be neutral. He wasn't ready to go back to Minsk II, but he would have given Russia its most important strategic demand. And do you not agree that Putin should have accepted that and declared victory begun the negotiation?
Yeah, but Peter, if I could fact check you right there, it's come out in the last few news cycles that the German chancellor spoke to Zelensky and actually said, you should declare that you will not become a member of NATO, maybe for a certain time period. So, I mean, and Zelensky said, no, okay? And this is one of the great missteps of going into this conflict here. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that there was a conversation.
Peter,
go ahead.
But
Peter,
we heard him also repeatedly say that Ukraine would not join NATO, and it was a non-starter, because everybody knew that Ukraine was not joining NATO, and that NATO didn't want Ukraine.
He said he was cooling to the idea. That's his exact quote here. Anyway, you asked the question of Daniel. Go ahead, Daniel.
Okay, so I mean, I agree with Peter, yes. I mean, if to the degree that was Zelensky's stance, Putin should have seized on it and made the most of it and run with the ball as far as he could. But I also agree that there is plenty of reason for the Russians to be skeptical, most important of which is that the United States would never have permitted it. The United States is clearly intent on using the Ukraine as a battering ram against Russia. And I'm not just being paranoid, because essentially Brzezinski laid out the entire scheme 25 years ago in great detail. And as far as we can tell, his book was highly influential in the U.S. Foreign policy establishment. It was never repudiated or rejected. So I think his ideas have had a great impact, and I think that the U.S. goal involves something along those Brzezinskian lines, to break up Russia, penetrate Central Asia, and then move on to China.
Okay, let's go to Max here. Hi, I want to pull in Max here. I mean, I have a very difficult time, you know, even if Zelensky said, okay, yes, we'll put a moratorium on it. Maxime, what kind of value do those words have? I mean, ever since the end of the Cold War, the U.S. has repudiated countless numbers of agreements. They've walked away. They've never taken Russia's security interests seriously. I mean, you know, it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but, I mean, you have a whole lineage of time where agreements are just not taken seriously. And then the Russians send out two ultimatums, because that's what they were, one to NATO, one to the United States, and they were just blown off. I mean, so I'm not sure the value of words here anymore. Max.
Well, you know, as we're thinking about this issue today here in Moscow, I think most of our thinking is that, you know, the events of the current events will be written and discussed by the historians, you know, why it happened and should have happened or should have not happened. The Rubicon is crossed, and we have to come from this view that, you know, what we've done, we can't go back and change it. But what I want to say is that the what seems to be a short-term gain for the West, and I totally echo the sentiment that we don't really see any willingness on part of the United States or the Europeans to help the negotiation process, more arms, Ukraine gets more strong in resisting and fighting Russia. So the war will rage on for some time. And the plan seems to be to get Russia stuck and indeed to create another Afghan campaign for Moscow. But I think the policy will ultimately echo and fire back, because the Biden's presidency was supposed to be about getting America stronger to counter China. And the ultimate victor in all of that seems to be exactly China.
Yeah.
And even though the United States believes that Russia is now losing, the Biden presidency will be accompanied by the crisis with Russia, as China will be cherry-picking and getting stronger and getting more challenging for the next U.S. president to deal with. And Russia will not go away, despite all the attempts to cancel it and to sanction it. It will not go away from the map. It will continue to be a strategic challenge for the West and for Europe. It will invest even more in its policies of de-Westernization, de-Americanization, de-dollarization. And a lot of the policies that the West is now pursuing will also contribute to those exactly trends, with the rest of the world and other countries thinking twice before willing to invest into American banks and system and things like that.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad Max brought that up, because that's where I wanted to go here. I mean, the ricochet effect here. I mean, I spend a good part of my day looking at the impact of sanctions all around the world, the lack of food security and things like that, all over the world. It's ricocheting all over the place. It's really difficult to comprehend where all this is going, because this is the first time a G20 country has been sanctioned like this, and no country's ever been sanctioned as much as Russia right now, and the implications of which are truly hard to comprehend. Peter.
Yeah, it created a very, very dangerous situation globally right now. I mean, Russia and Ukraine account for 38% of world wheat sales. We're talking Russia accounts for 20% of world fertilizer sales. Russia and Ukraine, 30% of world grain sales. We've seen the price of energy skyrocketing. We've seen the price of food and commodities going up. And many countries are destabilized by this. And it's only going to get worse, which is, again, why this needs to be ended as quickly as possible, because we are in an integrated global economy.
Yeah, but Peter, if we stand back, so was it all worth it for NATO to absorb Ukraine? Is that worth it now, looking back? You know, I mean, when people in Yemen and Ethiopia and Kenya say, why are we having a food crisis? Because the Americans wanted Ukraine in NATO. It's preposterous.
Well, I mean, it's interesting the way the world looks at this. I've been doing a lot of shows on Indian TV lately. And India is an interesting case, because India has refused to condemn Russia. In fact, India has strengthened its ties with Russia.
Yep.
Lavrov was just there after he went to Beijing. But the effect, I mean, a lot of countries see the broader context. They see NATO expansion. They see the role that Ukraine has played in terms of Russia's foreign policy concerns, you know, and they view it differently than the Americans and some of the Europeans do. You know, but this is something in narratives we've been debating for a long time. But we see the immediate impact, and we have hardly talked about the humanitarian catastrophe that's going on inside of Ukraine, which is also very, very troubling. Also, what's happening with the Russian military. I mean, there's a lot of reassessing that's going to go on in the aftermath of this as we try to figure it out. If the world can move forward from this, maybe we can get off of fossil fuels a little bit more, more dependence on renewables. That would be a good thing to come out
of. You know,
of
Peter, you know what another good thing would be, if I can go to Daniel, is that, you know, let's go back to square one. Every country should have the right to have its own security. I mean, and that's the argument I was making on this program for months, okay? Let Russia have security as well. No. Ukraine can have it. Everyone else can have it, except for the Russians. That's how we got here. Daniel.
Yeah. I mean, there'd be it'd be a better world if everybody made allowances for every country's security concerns. But the U.S. does not do that. The U.S. has targeted Russia, and the Democrats in particular have been on a decade-long campaign of demonization, painting Russia as the source of all evil in the world. I mean, a sparrow doesn't fall anywhere on Earth with Vladimir Putin somehow, you know, not causing it. It's a completely outrageous. And this kind of mindset is not one that leads to any kind of mutual accommodation. It leads to the opposite. It leads to, you know, to confrontation and insane, pointless warfare. But that's where we are now in. And clearly the U.S. has led NATO up to the doorstep. And it's only a matter of time before France and Germany begin questioning, you know, how the hell they arrived at this point.
Exactly. How did we get here? Exactly. We're rapidly running out of time. Max, you're the Russian on the program here. And looking at the displays of anti-Russophobic trends all through the West, in my mind, Western liberalism actually shows its true face, doesn't it? Okay. It's very bigoted. It's racist. And you can do it with impunity, Max.
Well, I think there's nothing surprising here, and I think that's pretty much been the talking points and then the discourse coming from the Russian side for decades. What I want to say is that the rest of the world, and I think Peter mentioned that, does not necessarily buy the things that the Western information and Western policymakers are saying. So indeed, Russia may be losing the information war in the West for the Western target audience. But it's not necessarily losing it in the rest of the world, in the Middle East in particular, in India, in China, if you look at their domestic discourse. And even though countries are not necessarily, you know, voting for Russia in the UN General Assembly and seek to, hatch their own risks with sanctions, politically, Moscow is not getting that kind of pressure the West thinks Russia is getting in the rest of the world. So I think we're still far from things being
all right. I'm going to jump in here. Peter, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I agree with Max about that. But back to Daniel's point, we've all been challenging this demonization of Putin rhetoric for years. But now, unfortunately, Putin has lived down to those people who have been demonizing him. I think what I've seen with the people I've been debating with is they feel vindicated. They've been saying that Putin was a thug and a tyrant and a dictator. And now he's given them more credibility than they ever had before or than they deserved. So another reason why I'm so angry with Putin about this, he's empowered the militarists, empowered the Russia haters, Russia bashers.
Well, Peter, are you glad that the ethnic cleansing of the Donbass has come to an end?
I hope that they've settled the Donbass.
I hope so, too. We started out the program with context, and there was a predicate, and let's not forget that context and predicate. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in New York, Bethesda, and here in Moscow. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.